third sitting in February. We have with us students, Central Wisconsin Christian High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a program, national award-winning program, sponsored by the State Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students across the state, whether private, public, or school educated, are invited to come, listen to an oral argument, and then meet with a justice assigned for the day to discuss the procedures that the court has for taking cases, hearing them, and then issuing an opinion. The substantive issue in the cases are not discussed. Everyone's invited, needn't be a student, to participate in this after the second argument session. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. She is the justice assigned today to talk with the students. To her left is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. And we will proceed to a calling of the first case, but before I do that, we will deal with the Government Accountability Board. This is by statute. Section 15.60 sub 2 says that the members of the Government Accountability Board shall be appointed from nominations submitted to the governor by a nominating committee to be called the Governmental Accountability Candidate Committee. And this nominating committee consists of one Court of Appeals judge from each of the Court of Appeals districts, and there are four Court of Appeals districts. The members of the committee serve for 2 years with terms expiring on March 1. That's coming soon. That's why we're doing this. The Court of Appeals judges shall be chosen as members by lot by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the presence of the other justices of the court. Service on the committee is mandatory, except as provided in Section 758.19.9. So I have discussed this with Kevin Kennedy, who's the Executive Director of the Government Accountability Board. You've done this any number of years, and I have four envelopes, not by any CPA accounting firm, and they're not sealed. They're open. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put the members of the District 1. In this hat, which comes from Mongolia, when last I was in Mongolia. All right, and I'm going to, Mr. Kennedy, yes, I want to introduce you to the students and the students to you, and I will now call a name, and it is Joan Kessler, Judge Joan Kessler of District 1. Now, sometimes I pick an alternate. Do you want me to do that? No, because it's mandatory that they serve. All right. I'll go to District 2. And I'll pick one of those. This is a committee that nominates, ultimately goes to the governor. And I've picked Paul Riley, Judge Paul E. Riley, District 2. That's Waukesha District. District 3. Alisa Stark. And District 4. Joanne Kloppenberg. Anything else I can do for you today? Well, thank you for always reminding us every 2 years and doing this. You'd approach the bench, Mr. Kennedy. Would you approach the bench?
Okay. We're sorry to hear about your brother.
Yes, Kevin, that's true. So sorry.
Thank you.
Oh, Kevin, that's wonderful. So nice of you to say. God bless you.
With that done, let me go to our first case, which is OLR versus Winkle. And arguing on behalf of Mr. Winkle is Patrick Kernan. Arguing on behalf of the OLR is Matthew Anik. And you have 25 minutes and 5 in rebuttal, Mr. Anik. You have 30 minutes. You may proceed, counsel.
Your Honors, I have the privilege of representing Attorney David Winkle, who is sitting at the table with me today, and I would like to use my time today to explain to you why we believe that a 4-month suspension of his law license, in addition to a $37,000 cost assessment in this case, is excessive, unreasonable, and the product of a hearing that I don't think took into account all of the factors that this court would need to consider in order to come up with what would be a proper sanction for Mr. Winkle's conduct. As you know, this court has complete discretion in terms of ordering discipline following a determination that a Supreme Court rule has been violated. This court owes no deference to the referee's recommendations or to what the OLR is requesting. The standard of review is de novo. Based on prior cases that this court has written, opinions in similar situations, this court is not bound by what it has done in any prior case. Rather, it is to look at the specific facts of this case and fashion a discipline that fits the unique circumstances of this case. In reviewing the unique facts of each case, the court is to take into account a number of guides or factors, including the nature of the attorney's misconduct, the need to protect the public, the court system, and the legal system from a repetition of the conduct, the need to impress upon the attorney the seriousness of the misconduct, and so that it's not repeated, and to deter other attorneys from engaging in similar misconduct. The court may, but doesn't.
Are we supposed to also look at the prior disciplinary record of the attorney before us?
Yes. According to the precedent from this court, the ABA standards on developing sanctions for attorneys, which this court has adopted, puts out a number of aggravating and mitigating factors which this court is not obligated to follow, but may follow and often does follow and probably should follow, take into consideration in this particular case. Yes.
Now, it's my understanding that your client does have a prior disciplinary record. Is that correct?
He does. Two matters, one in 1998 and another in 2005.
And both of those resulted in what discipline?
A reprimand plus costs.
And he's asking for that again here, right?
Yes.
Were the offenses similar in other cases?
There were some elements that were similar to this in one case. In one case, there was a claim by the clients that the hearings examiner found to be true, that he did not fully inform them of the ramifications of a certain decision, and that there was a representation that he had prepared a document which the hearings examiner found he did not. That was back in 1998. So, yes, those are obviously things that could be considered aggravating or mitigating factors. They were certainly brought out at the hearing. They were brought out at the complaint, and they were, one of the issues that concerns we have is the system permits what would otherwise be excludable other acts evidence into a hearing at the same time they're determining whether or not my client versus Peter Long was telling the truth about what happened during the representation. I have some concerns about that that would not be typical or heard of in any other court proceedings, but that's permitted or was permitted in this situation. But the unique facts of this case, I think, are very important to consider when applying these factors and these mitigating and aggravating factors that we're talking about. And the first aspect I'd like to talk about that is unique was what Attorney Winkle was doing during his representation of Peter Long. He certainly made mistakes during this representation. He did not properly handle the lawsuit that he agreed to take on, and he didn't effectively communicate with his clients regarding the status of this matter. He's required to do these things under the Supreme Court rules and the rules of professional responsibility. The counts of misconduct related to his representation are covered in counts 1, 2, 3, and 5, and the corresponding OLR rules that go along with those counts that are laid out in the complaint. Attorney Winkle admits that he should not have allowed Mr. Long's case to simply drift to a summary judgment situation, and he should have more clearly communicated and confirmed in writing the things he was communicating with his client, which he did not do. He is prepared to accept punishment for those things which are not right. He acknowledges that. However, in fashioning discipline and determining whether a four-month suspension of his license or any suspension of his license, in addition to the $37,000 of costs, are appropriate, it is essential to look at what circumstances he was dealing with, the specific facts of this case. The first circumstance that I think is very important is there was never a selfish or greedy motive involved in what he was doing with respect to his representation of Mr. Long. He never wanted the case that was eventually assigned to him. He turned it down repeatedly when Mr. Long had been writing and calling from prison asking him to take the case on. It wasn't until his father, who's a fairly prominent individual in Neenah, known to Mr. Winkle, came to him and said, "Can you help my son? He's in a drug addiction counseling center. He's got this lawsuit. He cannot maintain that lawsuit and at the same time stay in DAC, as they call it, because you're supposed to be focusing on staying clean and sober and getting better, not business, not lawsuits." And so on very short notice, he took on the representation while it was already an ongoing lawsuit. The case was not taken for money, for the kind of motives that people would typically take a lawsuit for. It was to help out this person that was known to Mr. Winkle. So This, I think, is an important factor to consider when separating
this. Is that the original case, the original criminal case, are you talking about?
No.
What case are you talking about?
The Mercer case. That was the Mr. Long was a prisoner in the Stanley Correctional Institute.
Yes.
He got an infection. He started a lawsuit, and that was what he asked Mr. Winkle to take
That's
on.
What I'm talking about. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Is the client hurt more or less if the motivation is bad?
I think that is a factor that puts it, you know, when deciding whether or not this case deserves a sanction versus a reprimand, that is a factor that is considered because we're looking at the nature of the wrongdoing. Was this a something greedy to enrich yourself, to self-promote, to do something illegal? No, this was driven out of not handling a case well that you probably should have never taken in the first place. That is, I think, an important factor to consider. The second, I think, essential factor is this issue of communications. He has an obligation to communicate with his clients, as we all do, under the Supreme Court rules. However, in this specific case, communication with his client was extremely challenging and difficult and unique. At all times during the representation, Mr. Long was incarcerated. He was incarcerated in three different institutions, and frequently would move without notice, creating communication issues. He couldn't meet Attorney Winkle at his office. He couldn't exchange emails with him. He couldn't call easily. If he wanted to talk to Mr. Winkle, he had to call collect. Mail was an issue. At DAC, he was specifically told, do not be working on business, do not be working on lawsuits, and they would monitor his mail. He claims his mail was frequently intercepted, read, and often taken and destroyed. Eventually, he was kicked out of DAC because he was engaging in business activities, which probably included this lawsuit. That was explained to Mr. Winkle. That was one of the reasons why he was asked to take the case on. So here you have a situation where you are being accused, and he certainly did not do as good a job as he could in terms of communication, but the communication circumstances he was under are completely different than almost all other situations that lawyers find themselves in. This was not easy. If he sends too much mail, if he does too many things, that interferes with his client's development in the DAC program. If he doesn't do enough, he's obviously violating the rules. That is a difficult situation to be in. It does not excuse not keeping him informed, but it does need to be considered when fashioning a remedy and determining whether a 4-month suspension of his license is appropriate. The next factor I think that's important to consider is this case, the MRSA lawsuit that Mr. Long was pursuing, did not have merit to it. He was told at the beginning that this was a slam dunk case, the state had admitted wrongdoing, I almost lost my leg, I'm entitled to substantial damages. Well, all lawyers know that when your client presents initially, you have to take some of that with a grain of salt. It has to be investigated. Mr. Winkle did not have the opportunity to do that. He had a federal court hearing, scheduling conference, within 2 weeks after that initial meeting. He had no records. He had no information. He took the case on the client's representation of what it was about. When he did finally get the medical records, had them reviewed by an expert that he retained and had, there was no merit to the case. It was suspicious to begin with, but then it was confirmed after he had taken it on that there was no merit. So when we're judging him about, well, you should have filed a witness list, you should have opposed a motion for summary judgment, you should have done more discovery, you should have done depositions, he was given $2,500 to go find an expert. He was asked to, on short notice, appear at a hearing. And after that, he gets information that shows the case is not valid. Now, he's being was charged and found in violation of Supreme Court rules in terms of diligently handling a case. He admits he shouldn't have just let it drift. But the question is, okay, a lawyer in this situation who has a case that is not meritorious, are you supposed to go do a lot of discovery and a lot of depositions and oppose a motion for summary judgment when there really is no basis in the fact or law?
Counselor, are you saying that the claim that your client was proceeding on was frivolous? Going that far?
I don't think frivolous. I don't know. I don't know. If you can't get an expert to prove an essential element of a case, and you continue to pursue the case, I would say then you possibly would be signing pleadings and papers that would be deemed frivolous. Was it frivolous at the outset? I mean, the elements were pled and the representations were made. He discovered, I think, that it would have been futile or frivolous, and I'm not sure. If you're
mounting a claim that's based on an injury to another person that requires a medical opinion that something was done negligently and you can't provide that opinion, and you've tried to provide it by having things reviewed, I don't know how you continued the lawsuit.
That was the situation he was in. And I think the question, is it frivolous? I think if you continued after that point.
Correct. Does it become frivolous?
Correct. In any event, he should have, what he knows he should have done is say, I can't continue, I'm going to withdraw, I'm going to get out of this. You don't just let pleadings come and go basically into default. That was wrong. That was not the proper way to handle this. But, again, in judging it, I think it has to be understood that the alternative, what he's accused of doing, you know, you should have filed witness lists within deadlines, you should have opposed motions, you should have done discovery without money, without a basis, without a reason, that I don't think we want to force lawyers to be doing that or face the kind of sanctions that we're talking about in this particular situation.
Well, what did the magistrate say here? Wasn't it Magistrate Crocker?
Yes.
And he didn't think your client did too well, did he?
He didn't think that my client did very well, yes, but I don't know if the Magistrate Crocker understood the situation. He said he should have gotten an expert and checked it out. He was very clear and slightly sarcastic about it. Before you put it on your checklist, before you filed a complaint. He didn't file a complaint. The complaint had already been filed by Mr. Long, pro se, and had been going on while he was at Stanley. It wasn't until he gets transferred to DAC and can't do this anymore that he brings in Mr. Winkle. Mr. Winkle didn't prepare this case, put it into suit. He was dropped into it well after it had started, which Magistrate Crocker did not, I think, understand that. It doesn't justify how it ended, however. I mean, that part of it is appropriately wrong.
I understand this. Your client agrees there were violations here.
Correct.
All of them that were ultimately charged. One had been withdrawn before.
Correct.
Okay. And your client is not objecting to the costs. Your client's only objection and his reason for being here is the sanction.
4-month suspension.
Right. And you would like a public reprimand.
Yes.
And OLR originally wanted 60 days, right?
Correct.
And the referee gave 4 months. That's double what OLR
Correct.
Had asked for. And as I understand it, one of the reasons for the increase over the requested 60 days was that your client was not necessarily cooperative or truthful in the proceedings before the referee. Is that correct?
Yes. I don't know about cooperative. It was Judge Kinney found that he was not truthful. He didn't believe his testimony and found that to be, in his opinion, not truthful. He said, if before the hearing, 60 days, I probably would have agreed with it, but after the hearing, He did himself no favors. He was incredible, and he went on. And that is the next part of my argument, that is not a legally legitimate basis for doubling the suspension time. The Supreme Court rule is very clear that count six, which is the not being forthright with OLR, that applies to the investigation that goes on before a complaint is filed and a proceeding begins. An investigation and proceeding are two different things. The OLR rule that's at issue here is 22.03 sub 6. It says, quote, in the course of the investigation, the respondent's willful failure to provide relevant information can be misconduct that can be disciplined. The judge was using this rule as his basis for saying, you know, he misled the OLR during the hearing. And there are frequent, I pointed them out in our brief, frequent citations in his decision where he was punishing or believing that Mr. Winkle needed to be punished based on the way he defended himself, based on his putting the OLR to its proof and not just admitting what they've accused him of, and then he didn't like the way he testified. Now, don't get me wrong, that you cannot be untruthful in a hearing. That is a problem, but if that's the case, that needs to be handled separately. You don't handle it within the hearing. That this Ruffalo case, the U.S. Supreme Court case that I cited in my brief, clearly states that you have the right to deny an allegation against you, put your opponent to its proof. If you lose, that doesn't mean you are now a liar or misleading and now are automatically going to be sanctioned even more. If you felt that there was some sort of misconduct during the hearing, that has to be handled separately, charged separately, and the respondent has a right to due process to notice what was it that you did wrong, was it intentional, and that's a whole separate proceeding. That didn't happen here. Judge Kinney clearly just said, I don't like what he said or the way he said it, and I'm going to, under count six, double the penalty because of the way he testified. That is not fair, and that's contrary to his right to due process. What the only evidence that was submitted at the hearing about any sort of being misleading somebody during the investigation was Mr. Winkle was accused of failing to return to the OLR three letters from his file, which the OLR already had. There is an exhibit that was marked at the hearing, which is the July 13, 2010 letter, where the OLR said, Mr. Winkle, please turn your file over. Here is the file materials we have. He turned his file over. It was missing three letters, but those three letters were in the file materials that the OLR was sending to Mr. Winkle. They already had it. This issue came up in the hearing. Mr. Onish said, well, we're not saying he did any misrepresentation to the OLR during the investigation. We're just saying he didn't cooperate by providing these three letters. At which point, Judge Kinney stopped the whole discussion and said, well, we're not going to suspend him for not turning over three letters to the OLR, which the OLR already had and was sending to Mr. Winkle. It didn't make any sense. That was the limit, the only things that the OLR came up with at the hearing to suggest that there was a failure to cooperate or be forthright in the investigation. The rest of it is all the way Judge Kinney interpreted my client's testimony at the hearing, which again, as we said, is not covered by the Supreme Court rule he's charged under. And it would be unfair to say, we're not going to negotiate, we're OLR, we don't plea bargain, we don't allow that. It's going to force people to go to hearing if they want to stand on their right to deny an accusation. And then if you lose the hearing and the judge doesn't like the way you testified, your penalty doubles. That's what happened here. That's not fair. The other part of this that we think is it didn't happen is a consideration of mitigating factors. Judge Kinney doesn't know much about Mr. Winkle. He doesn't know what he wanted to do with this case when it was presented to him. He doesn't know.
I'm sorry, before you proceed to that, on page 26 of the red brief of it says, referee Kinney states that aggravating factor, which is most concerning to him, is the respondent's submission of false evidence, false statements, and other deceptive practices during the hearing. This factor would be very serious even if the respondent had no prior disciplinary history. It then goes on to say in prior disciplinary history, the same kind of accusation was made, namely misstatements during the proceeding and misrepresentations. Do you is it your position the referee cannot consider that in a sanction?
The prior conduct?
No.
Or the
misstatements during the hearing. Because on the preceding case,
he can say, I don't believe you, and I'm not going to accept your word versus Mr. Long's based on the way you talk. That he can do. What he can't do is say, I'm going to come up with a new charge against you, which is not telling the truth, and without putting him on notice of what it was he said that caused him to do that, and just say, I'm going to unilaterally come up with a new charge. It's going to have a doubling effect on the penalty the OLR is currently seeking. No, he cannot do that under the Supreme Court rule that limits the misconduct aspect to during the investigation. Once the proceeding starts, it's a different thing. It has to be handled a different way. Refer out for a perjury, if that's what he thought. Start another file another complaint if that's what the case is. But you don't get to, within the proceeding, say, well, what you just said is a violation and I'm going to find against you and add penalties during the process. That can't happen.
As I recall, it's been a while since I looked at OLR's brief, there was some discussion about the, in OLR's point of view, major differences between deposition testimony and testimony at the hearing,
right.
And that Judge Kinney
right, which again would
that.
Be part of the proceeding. I mean, and you know, that's not part of the investigation, part of the proceeding.
I'd like to hear your response. It isn't as though a hearing being conducted by a referee is devoid of referees' assessments of personality. Truthfulness is part of the
sure.
personality. Sometimes we see in a referee's report that an attorney has no remorse, and that's considered as part of the overall recommendation on occasion. The attorney still denies it, even though the evidence is very strong and the referee concludes, certainly evidence supports violation, but there's denial, lack of remorse. Why isn't, with denial and lack of remorse, lack of honesty, if that's what the referee perceives at the hearing, a valid consideration for sanction?
There's two concepts, lack of remorse and lack of credibility, and I just mm-hmm. briefly want to talk about lack of remorse. In this situation where you say, I told him what the status of his case is, Mr. Long's saying, I didn't. And you choose to, which you have the right to do, say, I think he knew more than what he's saying. At the same time, in that same hearing, you're required to exhibit remorse. He has a lot of remorse and would just as soon not have gone through this whole process. And if there's a way he could have worked it out, it would have. But he's forced to do this because he's got six counts. One of them he doesn't agree with. So adding remorse during that hearing, I believe, would have been a very terrible mistake in terms of presenting the case. I don't think a person should be put in that dilemma.
I understand that.
And then the truthfulness part, Judge, is, yes, you need to be truthful, and if you're not, and if he felt there wasn't truthfulness, that's a separate charge that needs to be sent out. Otherwise, you're talking. You don't know whether or not that judge believes you, doesn't believe you, thinks you're a liar, and without notice or opportunity to explain why there's a big difference between the deposition and the interrogatories or requests for admissions, without that opportunity, you don't have the chance to even know what you're doing that's getting him so upset or how to defend yourself on it. I understand lack of credibility, you lose your case. That's where that comes in. If you're going to take it farther than that and punish him for it, that has to be a separate charge with an opportunity to deny it and put on your proof.
Page 25 of the red brief says, an aggravation factor in the ABA standards for imposing sanctions is F, the submission of false evidence, false statements, or other deceptive practices during the disciplinary process.
Process.
I understand your argument. If there is false evidence, false statements, or other deceptive practices during the disciplinary proceeding, the referee cannot consider them in imposing a sanction. Is that your position?
Well, the word was process, and I saw that too. I don't know what part of the process. Certainly, if there's deception during the investigative process, that's one thing. But during the proceeding, I think that it's not clear from that. Yes, you can be punished for it, but it would have to be, you'd have to single out what is it that he said that's wrong and then litigate it.
A separate yes. proceeding on it.
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to understand your position.
Thank you. The red light's on. I don't know.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Matthew Amish, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Good morning. My name is Matt Amish. I'm from Ashland and I'm retained counsel for the OLR in this proceeding. As I understand, the only issue is what discipline is appropriate. Respondent appellant is not challenging any other findings made by referee Kinney. The parties agree on the standards, so I'll skip over that.
Does OLR at this time seek 2 months or 4 months or something else?
The OLR's recommendation is a suspension of 60 days plus costs.
Okay. So they're not seeking to enforce the referee's suggestion to us.
The OLRs sought that in the complaint and in its post-hearing brief. That was the recommendation that Mr. Sellin came up with based on the information presented to the preliminary review committee. We understand where referee Kinney's coming from. We think his findings are right on track here, but we're not in a position to change our recommendation based
on... Okay, so basically we're not arguing about whether he gets suspended for 4 months as an OLR request or a request really by anybody. It's a suggestion that's in the referee's report, which, as we do with OLR's requests, we take it and look at it and consider it and then come up with what we think is appropriate. So today you're arguing to us that he should have a 60-day suspension and pay full costs, and I understand there's no argument about the cost, though $37,000 is quite a little bit.
It is a lot of costs.
Okay, I just want to be sure so I knew what OLR's position was. Thank you.
Yes, and as you know, it's not uncommon that a referee will disagree with the OLR.
Sure.
We don't know what the referee would have thought about it if there had not been what he found to be deception during the testimony and the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
The referee candidly did a better job, I thought, in identifying comparable cases than the OLR did.
Mm-hmm.
He pointed out that in the four cases the OLR cited, that 3 out of 4 had no prior disciplinary history and that a number of them had no prior what he calls serious. Judge Kenney.
I'm sorry. I have to clarify something. You say today you're asking for 60 days, right?
Yes.
On page 50 of your brief, you say the referee's report is your conclusion. 60 pages in length is well considered and insightful. For all this, the reasons, the OLR urges this court to approve and adopt the report and sanction recommendations of the referee. So to me, when I read that, you, although you started out with 60 days, you or someone from OLR was present at the hearings, you are now here supporting the referee's recommendations of 4 months. And that's what you say in your conclusion. And your arguments say that. Your arguments say that you support 4 months. I read the reference to the ABA standard. I did not go back and check the ABA standard. I shall. And I read the ABA standard to mean any part of the disciplinary proceeding from the very beginning through the adjudicative function of the referee. So I want to know what's your position. Is it that the referee's 4 months is supported? It's only a recommendation. This court makes the ultimate decision. Are you urging us to approve and adopt the report and sanction, or are you saying 4 months is too long, OLR sticks with its 60 days, and public reprimand is too short? What's the position of the OLR?
The OLR's position is that the referee's report is correct, but the OLR does seek a 60-day suspension with costs.
So we have to amend that page 50 of your brief.
Yes, please consider it amended.
Okay.
Mr. Honich, does that recommendation reflect the OLR's policy of graduated punishment? As Justice Crooks pointed out earlier, the respondent in this matter had been subject to prior discipline. He received public reprimands. So, going from basically 0 to 60 as opposed to 0 to 4 months. Is that what the main thrust of the amendment is?
That's a good question, Justice Gableman. As Referee Kinney pointed out, and I know that Mr. Cannon bristled when he read it, this is the third time that Mr. Winkle has violated SCR 20:8.4C, which Judge Kinney latched on to. He said he, since 1981, his analysis of the Supreme Court decisions has shown the court has distinguished between these counts that involve dishonesty in some respect and what he termed garden variety violations. And I believe he viewed counts 1, 2, and 3 to be more garden variety, where you're not communicating with a client, not providing competent representation, things like that. But Referee Kinney felt that the second time that Mr. Winkle was sanctioned by the court for a 20:8.4C violation, the OLR was seeking a 60-day suspension at that time. The referee in that case, Curry, first recommended another public reprimand, and the court saw fit to do that. And in his report, the referee thought that he more or less caught a huge break when that occurred. Now this is a third time, the same sort of thing. And I don't know if the referee was increasing the penalty solely because of
the prior one
or because of the fact that he felt he provided deceptive testimony here. We both did cite the Nussberger case. The Nussberger case was cited by Mr. Kanan, who indicated here's somebody who had two of these SCR 20:8.4C violations, and he got a 60-day suspension. The OLR cited it because it does support progressive discipline, which you asked about. And the director of the OLR came up with the what he thought was the appropriate sanction for us to pursue here, and that's what the complaint reflects and what is our intention at this time.
And you certainly, sir, are no stranger to acting in this capacity. I don't think it's inappropriate. You've said you have your marching orders from the OLR director. Is that consistent? You've been doing this for many years, as I recall.
Yes.
Is that consistent with your observations of what the penalty would be in a similar situation?
Well, it's always hard to say. It really is difficult in analyzing these cases. I've always been surprised that I can't find more prior cases on point, but each one is to some extent unique. It isn't just like having 10 theft cases in a row where, you know, there's more similarity. There's always a different combination commonly. I think that referee Kinney was quite insightful in his report that one seemed to be somewhat of an aberration, but for one reason or another, the referee thought that for Mr. Winkle's second violation that a public reprimand was sufficient. It kind of caught Judge Kinney as being a little low, and here he's back a third time. The OLR, as it felt from the beginning, this was a suspension case, and he hadn't been suspended before, and commonly, you know, a 60-day suspension is what the OLR felt was appropriate, and that's what we continue to seek. I think, that Mr. Kinney repeatedly says that he's being prosecuted or getting a greater penalty, I should say, because he went through the hearing. I don't think that's the case at all. I don't think it bothers a referee to go through a hearing. When we file these complaints and seek a suspension, we know that a hearing is certainly a real possibility. I think the problem the referee had was he didn't feel that he was candid at the hearing, and the problem the OLR had, well, it's his third time with a 20:8.4C violation, which involves dishonesty.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Counsel, tell me why you think 4 months is too long.
The OLR believes that referee Kinney's recommendation is a reasonable one. It's not the one that the OLR has been seeking in the case, but we understand exactly where he's coming from. The more times I read his report, the more insightful I believe it is. But
so you don't think 4 months is out of line?
No, but that's not what we're seeking. We do not believe it's out of line. We believe it is a reasonable sanction given that this is the third violation of a serious rule.
I'm going to still think that 260 days is a reasonable sanction, too, along with $37,000 of costs, right?
We do believe 60 days is a reasonable penalty. The costs are a lot driven by what the defense is. Among the costs, the court reporters are over $5,200.
Nobody's quarreling about them, so we don't really need to use your time on that. But it still is, as you agreed initially, it's a pretty good, we see a lot of costs, and that's high.
I agree. It's a lot of costs.
And we do have those numbers in a document dated April 21 of this year, of last year.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, I want to just follow up a little bit on the prior questions in terms of the sanction being recommended. It surprised me in some ways that you at the outset were arguing for 60 days. Maybe I didn't pay close enough attention, but in your brief it seemed to be all focused, that would be an exaggeration, but heavily focused on advancing and supporting the recommendation of the referee. The heading number 3, referee Kinney correctly applied the aggregating factors. The referee's sanction recommendation is based in part on precedent he identified. You made comment that earlier that you thought he did a decent job or pretty good job in looking at precedent. Referee Kinney's sanction recommendation is well supported by the evidence. So I really took your argument to be that you were, with those headings and that discussion that you were endorsing and supporting referee Kinney's sanction recommendation as being supported by the evidence, because that's what the brief said. I just want to make sure I understand it. It seems to me, even with this brief, and I think I accurately described its focus, you are here telling us that your client is requesting 60 days, and you're the attorney for your client, and that's what you're here arguing. Is that? Do I have a firm grasp of what may be the obvious then?
Yes, and I understand how you came to the earlier conclusion reading the brief, but the OLR's position that is that it was seeking a 60-day suspension in this case, and that's what
it's seeking. And they're sticking with that now.
But, you know, like I say, I can't quarrel with anything in referee Kinney's report. Referees don't always agree with the OLR. He did an excellent job, and
it's a little different than your brief, that you can't quarrel with it, because your brief was endorsing it.
Yes,
I understand
what you're
saying.
Somewhere
between the time of the brief and now, OLR says instructed you to request 60 days.
But you don't.
I did speak with Mr. Sellin, and he said our recommendation is 60 days, that Judge Kinney's recommendation is a reasonable one also, and we don't feel it's a public reprimand case. Mm-hmm. We've been unable to find any case where there was a public reprimand with this kind of a disciplinary hearing and this sort of charges.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, your opposing counsel has argued that Peter Long's case was really very weak. It almost sounded to me as though the mistakes that Mr. Winkle made were harmless error in relation to Mr. Winkle. What's your impression?
Our impression is that every litigant should be provided with competent representation in compliance with the Supreme Court rules, and that the Supreme Court rules are violated here. There's a lot of civil rights cases that get filed and get lost. There's some of them that are merely exemplary damages are awarded. We don't really know if there was deliberate indifference here to Mr. Long's serious medical need. The Attorney General's office conceded that he had a serious medical need. Now, whether this delay of 4 hours or whatever it was due to deliberate indifference, or it was merely a big institution taking a while to treat him, I don't know. There was never an identification of the nurse involved. No one ever took her deposition to find out the reason for the delay, why he wasn't sent down. Part of the problem here is the prison issued these ICE reports and said he should have been treated right away. Mr. Long was very impressed with that, where the prison basically admits that they should have done things differently. And Mr. Winkle wrote him this letter in January and got his hopes up and kind of created a monster to some extent, telling him his case is worth $5,000 to $25,000 without medical testimony, that his attorney fees are going to be paid. I think that Mr. Long thought he could advance some money towards costs, he'd get reimbursed, he'd get his attorney fees paid, he'd get this money. There's no downside for him. There's no risk to him. The attorney's bearing all the risk. I think that Mr. Winkle got into this case and realized it wasn't a great case. At most, it would be exemplary damages after he spent a lot of time and effort on it. So he neglected it, and he didn't let his client, didn't keep him informed about the summary judgment motion. He didn't oppose it. He more or less was in a situation, I believe, of neglect at some point. But then when he went on his hunting trip for a few weeks and got back and saw there's a summary judgment motion that was highly critical of him and a dismissal of the federal case, and he knows how Mr. Long is. He's a demanding guy who thought he had a valuable case here. I think he got into the mode of concealing it from his client and then misleading his client in the December 14th letter, acting like the case was still pending and they probably wouldn't get past summary judgment when, in fact, it had been dismissed 2.5 months before. And then he continued on when the OLR asked about it. He said, oh, he had this meeting with Mr. Long and told him about it, when that meeting never occurred. His meeting with Mr. Long was before the case was ever dismissed. So I think he got down this path and he resorted to being deceptive to his client and to the OLR. And in the letter of the OLR, he misrepresented that. In his discovery response, he did. Mr. Kanan and I both, without knowing what the other one was doing, wrote to the prison. We learned that Mr. Long was correct. The meeting they had was on September 25th, before the summary judgment was decided, that it wasn't until after that the case was actually dismissed. And I think he could have come clean a lot earlier, bailed out. It would have come out a lot different. But when you start to get down the path and you start trying to deceive your way out of things, you start violating other Supreme Court rules, and I think that's why we're here today.
You handled the hearing?
I'm sorry?
You handled the hearing before Judge Kenney?
Yes, it extended over a period of 3 days, three different days.
And Judge Kenney seemed to be quite upset about Mr. Winkle's testimony?
Well, it's hard to tell when you're at the hearing exactly how the judge is viewing or the referee is viewing things, but I think from his referee's report, he put a lot of effort into it, and he does seem to be concerned about the changes in the testimony between depositions and at the hearing and things like that.
Now, you've been around the track a few times. Did you think that there was something really out of line in what Mr. Winkle was saying and doing?
About his doing what?
Were you troubled by Mr. Winkle's testimony?
I don't believe that he was totally candid, yes. Now, Mr. Kanan makes a point of saying, let me find it. One of the mitigating factors and one of the, the aggravating and mitigating factors that are set forth in the standards for imposing lawyer sanctions and the ABA standards, one of them is this refusal to acknowledge wrongful nature of conduct. And that's been a theme in his brief, that it's not true that, you know, that's an aggravating factor here. And I recognize his point about it's hard to show remorse at a hearing like this where you're contesting it. But I believe that he has refused to acknowledge the wrongful nature of his conduct. If you look at his answer to the complaint, he denied each of the violations. His post-hearing brief says the OLR didn't prove any of the charges. And I found nothing until today where he's saying he acknowledges the wrongful nature of his conduct, because he's always denied the conduct to begin with. He's admitted to all kinds of things that aren't Supreme Court rule violations, but the whole issue of this hearing is whether these Supreme Court rule violations occurred. And when he denies all of them up until his presentation this morning, I don't know how you can say that he acknowledged the wrongful nature of his conduct. He says, I used poor judgment. I never should have taken the case. I should have bailed out earlier. You know, different things like that are fine, but he hasn't admitted to any of the violations. The OLRs had a strong case here. They didn't even submit proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law after the hearing when he had an opportunity to do so. So, you know, I think that the judge was right on there. And when he talks about motive, you know, I think the motive, a lot of it was just neglect early on, but at the end where he started misrepresenting things, I think he's trying to avoid a malpractice case from Mr. Long, which, you know, of course, was obviously a real possibility here.
When a respondent is contesting charges that have been filed, when is the appropriate time to express remorse? Tactically, strategically, legally? I'm not quite sure I understand how to get out of the dilemma that the respondent is in.
Well, I don't know exactly how to address that. It obviously has to be at the hearing, since there is a single hearing. I know Mr. Kanan's brought up this issue of bifurcation of whether there should be a hearing on the facts and a hearing on disposition and things like that, but obviously if you only have one hearing, you have to present that evidence at some point. And I think one of the footnotes that were in the report from Referee Kinney addresses that issue to some extent. you know, how do you do these two different things at the same time?
You did closing arguments
here
to the referee?
I'm trying to recall if we did do closing arguments or not. I'd have to look at the transcript.
I don't recall that. I think after 3 days.
I think we were pretty tired at the end of the third day. And
did you at any time indicate that there was a departure from the depositions in Mr. Winkle's testimony? Cross-examine him?
I believe that I certainly did in our post-hearing brief point out those variations. Mr. Winkle's secretary...
Post-hearing brief submitted to the referee?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's your closing argument anyway.
In effect here, it was.
That's right. So you pointed out the discrepancies?
Yes.
Did the referee rely on what you wrote?
Did I rely on that?
No, did the referee, I'm sorry, rely on what you had pointed out?
I believe that he did to some extent, and probably mainly on what he heard, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure we heard the same thing.
And when you were before the referee, did you make a recommendation as to the sanction, the discipline? I know your complaint asked for 60 days. What did you ask the referee to do?
I don't recall if we had a closing argument or not. I'm thinking that Mr. Kanan's right, that maybe we didn't.
Okay,
but our position certainly at that time was a 60-day suspension was appropriate.
Continued on with that. Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do the ABA standards, in your opinion, say that if there's been misleading evidence or misrepresentations during the proceeding, that is an element for the referee to consider in mitigation or in increasing penalty?
I believe that's an interesting issue. I think you're correct that the ABA standards under aggravation,
right.
I believe sub F, do say that that is an aggravating factor. I understand Mr. Kanan's point, but I understand what the remarks Justice Bradley made, too. All these things apparently are available for a referee to take into account. I don't think that Ruffalo case he cited is on point, because in Ruffalo they actually came out and added a charge right in the middle of the hearing. Mm-hmm. We don't have that here.
No.
But we do have a case where Judge Kinney did apparently consider that as one of the aggravating factors.
Mm-hmm. You see, you had a case. Was that, what case was that?
The Ruffalo?
No, the way a referee considered it as an aggravating factor that there were misrepresentations or misstatements or misleading evidence during the proceeding.
Yeah, under the ABA standards, aggravation 9.22 sub F, which I believe you referenced earlier.
I got it from your brief.
Okay.
Was there a Wisconsin case that said that? That applied that standard?
I'm not aware of any Wisconsin case, and that is something that the referee located and put in his opinion. I don't believe that was in any in our post-hearing brief.
Okay. So as I understand, the only difference between you, well, we've got three parties. I use the word parties loosely. We've got Mr. Winkle. He thinks, and the only issue is discipline, right?
Yes.
He thinks it's public reprimand. We've got the OLR, and your party, and you think it's 60 days. And we've got the recommendation of the referee, and we are here reviewing the recommendation of the referee. And we review the referee by accepting the facts, right, unless clearly erroneous, and reviewing the legal issues de novo, but we don't really have to do that because there are no legal issues before us, and the sanction is just a recommendation. You agree with that?
Pretty much. I believe it's almost kind of like a legal issue that was raised by Mr. Kanan here about the appropriateness of that 922 sub F of the ABA standards, about whether if someone testifies falsely in the presence of the referee, is that a ground? Is that something the referee can take into account as an aggravating factor? And that seems to be what the ABA standards seem to say that I believe a lot of states do follow. But I'm not aware of a case on point in Wisconsin.
Thank you.
In their reply brief, they raise the issue about the OLR not being able to plea bargain. It's my understanding the OLR is not able to drop counts that are well supported simply in order to resolve a case. I don't believe it's appropriate to bring that up on the reply brief when we had no opportunity to address it earlier, but I don't think it made any difference in this case. I don't believe that the OLR would have agreed to anything that did not involve a suspension, and I don't believe that Mr. Winkle was willing to agree to a suspension, so I don't think we would have gotten anywhere whether we could plea bargain or not here. In conclusion, we urge you to impose a suspension. This is not a public reprimand case. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Just a few comments. Yes, it's about this process. I didn't get to that part of my argument in response to some of the things Mr. Onich just said. One of the problems, in addition to the circumstances that Mr. Winkle had and the confusion I think that the judge had about how to apply the count six, and you know, is it during the testimony or prior to, the other part of this is I think the unfairness of the current system we have for evaluating lawyer misconduct and at the same time requiring them to come forward with mitigating factors that are extremely relevant, especially at this phase, to coming up with fair discipline. I mentioned in the other argument about this idea that you can introduce other acts evidence, which obviously influenced Judge Kinney. It influenced him on how much he was going to sanction my client. I can't imagine it didn't influence him on the he said debate that was clearly going on before him. I don't know how any trier of fact could fairly judge somebody in a situation like this with other act evidence.
By prior bad acts, are you referring to the prior adjudication?
Correct.
Isn't that standard in courts throughout the
country? No, Your Honor, not as against the defendant. That would be barred by the other acts evidence statute. You couldn't bring in prior convictions.
No. I mean, well, prior convictions. Prior convictions are brought into trial all the time, and they don't go into the substance of them, but at least the number, a number is fixed prior to trial. And if questioned, it runs to the idea, and I'm not supporting it, and I'm not denigrating it, but that's the law, at least in our...
In certain circumstances, whether a problem that happened in 1998 is relevant or even mentionable in a problem, there's a whole hearing and a consideration that goes into it. And typically, the trier of fact, the jury, isn't part of that hearing. This problem is we've merged all these decisions in one person who is now... You know, in the OLR's complaint, it's the second paragraph. They're talking about prior bad acts.
Are you suggesting that maybe we should look at our process, and since the prior convictions are really relevant only to the sanction,
yes,
that they not be presented to the
yes,
referee and that they be presented to us for decision-making,
correct,
but not to the referee
yes,
in his fact-finding?
Yes, absolutely. And that goes to the second part, the opportunity to show remorse. Judge Kinney said my client, one of the reasons he's hitting him with a big suspension is he didn't seem to show remorse. Well, there's not much of an opportunity to do that when you're in a battle over he said, he said, you're not going to say, I didn't do that, but I'm very, very sorry that, you know, that I did that. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. This determinations of did a party really want to go to this hearing or would they have preferred to work this out, which in most other litigation always occurs. There's no opportunity to do that. And if you were to bring into the hearing your efforts to try to work this out, you would be undermining your case that you maybe offered or did pay restitution to try to make it, you know, to try to solve the problem. You wouldn't put that into the hearing on a he said thing. That would be tactically suicidal. That you've changed your practices, that you learned from this and you're doing things differently. You wouldn't do that. That's a subsequent remedial measure that in most cases would win. When you merge both the penalty phase and the merits phase all in one hearing, all in one person, that is not going to give result in, I think, a fair, as we understand it in other courts, outcome. And I think that's a major consideration that has to be taken. Would this have been different if we bifurcated it and there wasn't other acts evidence? Would there be such anger about Mr. Winkle's attitude if he had heard in a separate hearing all the things that he did and would like to introduce to your honors as mitigating circumstances? Would the outcome have been the same? I don't think so.
Well, there are two ways of attacking that problem. One is to bifurcate.
Yes.
Right? The other way is that the referee doesn't make any recommendation. It just deals with the legal issues, factual and legal issues about the rule violation, and that's another way of dealing it. And the third way, which is the present way, is the one you're objecting.
Yeah, but the part about the second way is at some point there has to be an opportunity, a post-sentencing hearing, mm-hmm. I don't do criminal work, but I just, you know, where people talk about what's right for this person.
Well, maybe it should be before the court because we have the ultimate say.
Yes. If the referee's only recommendation and it doesn't mean anything, then why are you...
Not that it doesn't mean anything. It's not binding, just like the OLR is not binding.
Right. I also think that this change in position of they went in 60 days, they wrote a brief 60 days, and now it's wrote a brief saying they wanted 4 months, and now it's changed. Something's happened. I find that also a part of the...
Well, you understood that he would be arguing for 4 months.
Yes. And we're
why
here.
Did you understand that?
That's what was in his brief. That's what he said, that they wanted 4 months based on what the referee had recommended.
Well, but we got that clarified today because the OLR is asking for 60 days, which is where they started. I want to go back to your suggestion for just a minute because we look at these rules from time to time. If I understand you correctly, you think that his prior findings of violation of ethical rules affected the court's fact-finding,
yes.
Too, not just the sanction recommended.
Yes. You can never know what's in the mind of a fact-finder, but I got to believe if you look at the tone and tenor of that decision, that was an important part.
Mr. Keenan, I just have, without going into the merits or substance of this case, and obviously we're going to go back into the conference room, we're all going to give our views, but I do want to note, I think it's good to note, that in going on my seventh year here, I have not heard an attorney in a similar situation bring up the two points that you have made, and I think it's very good that you have brought them up, and at the least, at the minimum, you have given us all some good things to think about.
Thank you.
Mr. Cannon, I asked...
Justice Prosser.
I asked... Mr. Anich, several questions that I thought were that related to your initial presentation. I was not trying to get a rebuttal. I was trying to get a response. Now, I think I need to offer you the opportunity to respond to anything he said in his response.
I made a note, Justice Presser, when you were asking...
I got to admit, my notes are kind of a mess.
Well,
could you help me with the question?
I asked a question about, I think you made a case that Peter Long's case was really pretty weak.
Yes.
And then I asked a question about the referee's reaction to Mr. Winkle's testimony and whether Mr. Anich had the same kind of reaction. And it didn't strike me that he just went after him, but I think you should have an opportunity to respond to anything he said.
Yeah, I remember the question about did it appear that Judge Kinney was upset during the hearing with the testimony, and I would agree, no, which again is a problem because now we're not on note. I mean, if somebody says, you know, you just said something, I have a real concern with that. That might be, that's the notice you need to explain how the fact finder thinks that there's a new violation. You just lied, and that's perjury, and I'm going to punish you for that. In any other setting, you'd have to refer that out. That would be investigated. Was it a lie? Was it a mistake? Was it intentional misleading? Was there some information that came up between the time of the deposition and the time of the hearing that would justify that adjustment to testimony? I mean, there's a whole lot of considerations that have to go into discerning between a mistake and an intentional deceit that would require a punishment like this. And no, we did not see any reaction. It wasn't until we read this 60-page harsh criticism of Mr. Winkle and, frankly, the way we presented the case that it was very apparent he was not only not believing him, but mad at him and wanting to punish him for what he said and how he said it.
That happens in criminal cases where the judge makes that. The only difference is you have the right to discuss it with the judge at sentencing.
Or if it's referred out, it's referred out to, for, you know, as a...
No, no. If the judge, if very few perjury cases, and I don't know that this is perjury, but if the judge thinks there's been misleading statements or not telling the truth, the judge can take that into account in sentencing for a criminal offense. The difference here is you had no opportunity, as I hear you, to debate that with the
right.
judge.
The other big difference is the judge doesn't usually fill out the verdict as to whether or not somebody's guilty or not.
Well, you can have a trial to the bench, and the judge does fill that out.
Sure.
And in many cases, there's other acts evidence presented in the case to the jury or the judge, in it's for motive, purpose, intent, plan. And I can't remember a case in this court where that was said, no good, too distant, no good. And the judges do that all the time. We get cases at least once or twice every 2 or 3 months where the defect is other acts evidence that went in the fact part of the case. Okay. Even though there may be a curative instruction that this should not be used for guilt, but this is for plan, motive, intent, blah, blah, right?
Right, right.
And... So the judge didn't have to give himself the instruction here, did it? Did he? He's supposed to know that in a judge.
Right.
Trial.
Yes.
So I think you have a very interesting point about bifurcation and an interesting point about opportunity to do that. But you've got a lot of problems on the other end of saying this was a serious defect, I think, in the whole proceeding. But I plan on filing, just so you know, a rule that would have review of the OLR and the rules of the code, the rules of professional responsibility. And I may use this example you gave as one of my examples.
I hope there's changes for all the lawyers. But I really hope that for Mr. Winkle, this process doesn't put him in a situation where he's out of work for a very long time with a $37,000 cost on top of it. I think that's
You're not suggesting someone can buy a lesser sanction by paying money, are you?
No, but I think the whole level of punishment here should be taken into account, which
including the costs.
Yes.
Like the Civil War, where people could buy their way out of serving in the Army.
I don't know if I got that.
I'd agree to that.
You don't have to respond to that. Thank you.
Be wise not to.
Thank you very much to both lawyers in discussing this very interesting fact situation and a referee report. That ends 2012 AP 1845D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Winkle. I know there's difficult cases for both sides here, and the court appreciates that and appreciates your coming and appreciates Mr. Winkle. Thank you.